This is the, maybe we won't do that with children in the audience, never mind. In part two, Constance Barton, the wife, has brought in a psychic, a spiritualist, to help her rid the house of these ghosts that are troubling her. And this is now from part two, where the perspective of the story shifts, and the psychic herself tells this. The story is told from her point of view. And the narrator says, "I cannot imagine that Anne Montague was ever a beauty of any sort. She had been on the stage, true, but never in roles that demanded great physical grace, the confidant, the woman spurned, the less favored sister. No pictorial evidence of her youth survives, or none that she ever showed to me. But there must once have been, somewhere, sketches, at least, if not paintings or a photograph, commissioned by some admirer, a man of lesser wealth, I must suppose, who could not afford to keep a real leading lady, and so instead, after a swift and frank stage door negotiation, armed only with sparse bouquets and tables at lesser restaurants, one Anne Montague, horse-like and loud, a nymph of no conceivable water, but still an actress. Still he was keeping an actress, and he could boast over a chop, 'She'll bankrupt me, she will, but she's worth every penny,' and he'd incline his head and accept toasts to the health of a devilish fine fellow. Anne Montague was a specific and acquired taste, to be sure, and it would have been the rare gentleman indeed who was so taken with her that she ever woke for a few days, or perhaps a few weeks, in a private flat, surrounded by pale luxuries. These were few and brief, these interludes. But at last, her career upon the boards arrived at its intended and happy conclusion. Wealthy James Montague asked for Anne's hand, and with it in his, he led her from the stage. Anne was intemperately proud in her departure, offending many who would, a year later, recall the snub and gladly deny her roles or even friendly assistance. That single year later, her stage career over, her spendthrift and by no measure wealthy husband now dead, and bleak financial waters roiling about her, she set herself uneasily afloat, using such skills as she had acquired in her previous profession. Her subsequent record of success as a consulting spiritualist, as with all of those compassionate listeners who minister to invisible troubles and complaints, eludes flawless quantitative measurement. She certainly captained unequivocal triumphs where explicit ghostly visitors were shown the door thanks solely to her intercession and her practical guidance, the use of roots, holy symbols, incantations of expulsion. Conversely, many ladies wished, of course, to hear from those they had lost. In truth, Anne scarcely knew a woman who did not, especially those stranded in marriage, particularly if marriage had required the removal of a young girl from an Irish or country family to a new home and life in faraway London. Who did not long to gaze upon a dead parent or sibling, child, friend, animal? And so she summoned those sorely missed dead. She drew forth their faces from within looking glasses and upon clouds of smoke. She loaned her mouth to their voices, her writing hand took their dictation, and their survivors wept and paid with satisfaction. And there were also failures, no good denying it. She was clumsy at times, and she was shown out of homes where her work was lacking. And she was pursued, once, perhaps twice, one forgets, by angry husbands who would have reclaimed their wives' pin money, dispersed to this neighborhood witch, charlatan, thief, actress. How could Mrs. Montague have known that one lady received so little allowance that she paid her fee from sums removed from her sleeping husband's pocket, blaming that wandering money on his forgetfulness when roughly interrogated? She learnt that husbands were capable of deluding themselves to find the tale, denying the ghosts they had certainly seen, describing a world more suited to their philosophies rather than amending their philosophies to allow for the world, preferring to treat any evidence of ghosts as the superstitions of old wives, a phrase of which Mrs. Montague grew terribly tired in her years. She therefore always discouraged her ladies from sharing their investigations with the gentlemen. She would admit, too, in some tragic cases when she was first learning the nuances of her second trade, that her science simply failed against the superior strength of massed darkness. The old woman who lived for too long alone under the eaves of an ancient house in Wallace Road, for example, hanged herself, but not before she had written a long, long letter. It was not soon read because, having no one to call on her or to note her absence from anything or anywhere, she had hung from her ceiling beam for a long stretch of winter cold before a turn of the weather prompted complaints of leaking from the ceiling below, which led, in turn, to a forced entry. The letter, left beneath her feet for easy discovery, was rendered illegible in many places by the same natural outpouring of life that had so inconvenienced her downstairs neighbors. And what could be read, however, complained bitterly of Anne Montague's failings as a friend, as a protector, as illegible. The deceased also wrote with equal venom of the sneering local children, the conspiracy of dogs and cats, the fairies and air pixies, the long-toothed spiders in her walls and in her ears. All of these she blamed more than Anne Montague for giving her a life no person could bear, as God is my witness. But she flung curses at Anne's head, for Anne had not dispatched them to the other world like as she'd promised and what been paid for. But she would not have been able to survive solely by ridding Holmes of objective supernatural disturbance or summoning for conversation the promptly talkative dead. For example, at times people very much wished to see ghosts, but the ghosts would not appear on demand. In such a stalemate, it was certainly best to provide the bereaved with the simulation and stagecraft that satisfied their needs, rather than to deny them this simple kindness only because the petulant residents of the other side could not be troubled to respect the wishes of those they'd left behind. And in some cases, many cases, Anne discovered she could succeed merely by listening well to the living, to the wife who at last spoke freely of her loneliness or her distaste for her husband's manner or her pain over children lost in war or factory work. And after a few such candid chats over the weak tea, the air in the house stopped heating and chilling in turn. The water flowed without moaning or bleeding. Dishes no longer leapt from hands to smash against the walls. Beds ceased to shake in intimidation, and Mrs. Montague received lavish thanks and her small, discreet payment. She explained for a certain type of haunted customer, young, lonely mothers and brides aching for numbness in the third or fourth bitter flush of marriage, the nature of the world. Teach them how to adapt to conditions beyond their escape. She taught from her own experience how they might more comfortably manage their lot, their husband's demands, their isolation. If this conversation was conducted entirely as a discussion of and treatment for phantoms, so be it. That doesn't mean ghosts do not exist. It means simply that they were not the only problem a young woman might face when placed in daily proximity to a man, wretched with appetite and corrupted by his new position of unchecked tyranny. This is obviously my most autobiographical work, as that passage reveals. Do people have anything they want to ask about?